The scripture reading for this morning will be Luke chapter 12, verses 13 through 21. Someone in the crowd said to him, "Teacher, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me." But he said to him, "Man, who made me a judge or arbitrator over you?" And he said to them, "Take care and be on your guard against all covetousness, for one's life does not consist in the abundance of his possessions." And he told them a parable, saying, "The land of a rich man produced plentifully. And he thought to himself, 'What shall I do? For I have nowhere to store my crops.' And he said, 'I will do this. I will tear down my barns and build larger ones. And there I will store all my grain and my goods. And I will say to my soul, Soul, you have ample goods laid up for many years. Relax, eat, drink, be merry.' But God said to him, 'Fool, this night your soul is required of you, and the things you have prepared, whose will they be? So is the one who lays up treasure for himself and is not rich toward God."
Morning. Continuing our series this morning out of Luke, looking at Jesus as our master teacher, and as he, in particular, as he helps us how to live a life that has some meaning. This morning we've titled the lesson, "Master, Teach Us What Matters." Because we find in life, it is first of all filled with a lot of things that seem not to matter. Even the kind of most cursory look at your life, you realize you spend a lot of time worrying about things that didn't amount to much. And that's the obvious stuff. But even when we take the obvious things away, it turns out that we still have a tendency as humans to put a lot of value in all the wrong places. We don't know what actually counts as meaningful, as valuable. And this is an age-old problem. One of the central questions, it's going to take me a little while to get to Luke this morning because I want to actually trace this thought. One of the central questions of the wisdom literature of the Old Testament and elsewhere is the discussion of how do you even live a life that could possibly matter when so many of the things we do in life seems not to matter at all. In the Bible's most cynical book, if we can say that, the book of Ecclesiastes, we get an opening line. Well, let's see if we can make my clicker work. Aw. Maybe we just get a title slide today. Hang on. Here we go. How about that? "Vanity of vanities," says the preacher. "Vanity of vanities. All is vanity." I told you it was a little bit cynical, right? That the book of Ecclesiastes has a fairly grim view of life. It seems to be a book written by Solomon, though he never actually says, "Hi, my name is Solomon." But it seems like written by Solomon, or someone much like him, who has lived a fairly full life. And in old age is looking back and is deeply disappointed by everything he's done and experienced in life. This, by the way, is what all of us are trying to avoid. No one wants to get to their deathbed and say, "Well, that was all useless." Right? No one wants to get to the end and say, "None of that mattered." And that is close to where the author of this text has arrived. By the time he gets to the very end in chapter 12, he finds something that he says, "This mattered." But the rest of it, it's very grim that he says, "I just spent so much time doing things that don't matter." The word vanity is actually the traditional translation in most of our texts, but probably doesn't even give us the full sense. The word in Hebrew is hevel, which is the word that basically means something like emptiness. If I can, still having some clicker trouble. There we go. The definition, well, now it's going to go three times. What do you know? There we go. Meaninglessness, the quality of having no value or significance as a result of being futile or insubstantial or absurd or incomprehensible. That's a big definition for one word. But all of those meanings are kind of wrapped up into that word. Probably the best one-word definition you could give it in English is empty. That it just didn't have any substance to it at all. And then you have to figure out why, and that's what the definition does. It says things like, "Oh, maybe it didn't amount to much, or maybe it was silly, or maybe it was incomprehensible." But whatever it was, it didn't amount to anything. And that's his conclusion on pretty much everything he had done in life. We're going to come back to Ecclesiastes in just a moment, but I want to start elsewhere, actually, and notice that he's not the only one that feels this way. In the book of Psalms, Harry, I may just have to point at you or something. I'm having some clicker trouble. Psalm 49, 5 through 9 starts out by saying this: "Why should I fear in times of trouble when the iniquity of those who cheat me surrounds me, those who trust in their wealth and boast of the abundance of their riches? Truly no man can give ransom or can ransom another or give to God the price of his life, for the ransom of their life is costly and can never suffice, that he should live on forever and never see the pit." So at the end of the day, why should I worry about anybody who's out to get me? This is kind of a funny way of being cynical. He says, they're going to die too. There's nothing they can do. No matter what they do to me, everybody faces the grave, and it's pretty grim. So in verses 10 and 12, he says, "For he sees that even the wise die. The fool and the stupid alike must perish and leave their wealth to others. Their graves are their homes forever, their dwelling places to all generations. Though they called lands by their own names, man in his pomp will not remain. He is like the beast that perish." Well, there's something rosy for a sunny morning to consider, right? It's pretty grim. And what is it that he says? Several phrases in there just catch my attention as being just wonderfully biting. Dwelling place to all generations, though they called lands by their name, right? You might have a country named after you, and in that country, you might have a palace layered in gold that you lived in, and you built this monstrosity throughout all the days of your life. He says, in the end, you'll spend a lot more time in the grave than you'll ever spend in your mansion. In the end, the house that you live in for most of your life, the house you spend most of your time in, is not the mansion you built. In fact, it's a hole in the ground that looks a whole lot like the same house the poor man lives in. There's not a lot of difference. All the pomp comes and goes, and he is like the beasts that perish. The Bible spends a lot of time reminding us that every human is made in the image of God and has great worth and value. But then once in a while it slips in behind us and says, but by the way, you die like a dog. Right? By the way, there is one way in which you're very much not like God. And that is everything you accumulate and everything you get and everything you have just kind of disappears at some point and you don't take it with you. Going back to Ecclesiastes, we can say that this is actually a theme he develops at considerable length. Ecclesiastes is one of the hardest books in the Bible to read because he often says things that are wrong on purpose. What preachers do, sadly, is they quote the parts where he says something that's wrong, and they don't quote the part where he says, but that wasn't right. And so you kind of have to watch, because what he'll do is he'll say something, and then he'll say, yeah, but that was bad. Okay, so for example, I, the preacher, have been king over Israel and Jerusalem, and I applied my heart to seek and to search out my wisdom, all that is done under heaven. He says, well, I learned lots. How'd that work out for him? It is an unhappy business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. I have seen everything that is done under the sun, and behold. Really not a day for my clicker to be out of whack. Harry, give us the next line. There we go. All is vanity and striving after wind. I looked at everything I could possibly find. I examined every facet and feature of life. And he says, it wasn't very good. Most of the things we spend our time on amounted to nothing. It was vanity, emptiness, striving after wind. Chapter 2, 18 through 19, he does a considerable lengthy discussion of this idea, giving you all the options he considered as they relate to his wealth. If this is Solomon, this is a man who knows something about a dollar or two. He says, I hated all my toil in which I toil under the sun, seeing that I must leave it to the man who will come after me. And who knows whether he'll be wise or a fool. Yet he will be master of all of which I have toiled and use my wisdom under the sun. At the end of the day, he said, I worked really, really hard, and my kids might be dumb, right? I've got to leave this to somebody else who didn't work for it, who won't appreciate it, and might just waste it. he says, Harry gives another one. He says, this also is vanity, right? There was no way to get around this. And so he says, I came up with another solution. So I turned about and gave my heart up to despair over all the toil of my labors under the sun, because sometimes a person who has toiled with wisdom and knowledge and skill must leave everything to be enjoyed by someone who did not toil for it. He said, so my next step, when I realized I had to leave it to somebody else, was just to not care anymore. I tried despair for a while. I just didn't care about anything. He says, turns out, despair, this also is vanity and a great evil. But living a life where you don't care about anything, that doesn't amount to much either. He said, okay, so maybe I need to think about it harder and I'll come up with a solution. What has a man from all the toil? Hey, you bringing me another clicker? Try that one, huh? Good people up here, tell you what. Hey, yay, thank you, sir. You get a gold star today. What has a man from all the toil and striving of heart with he toils beneath the sun? All his days are full of sorrow, and his work is a vexation. Even in the night, his heart does not rest. He said, I stayed up late trying to fix this problem. If this is Solomon, again, he's a smart guy. It's not that he just wasn't smart enough to figure it out. He said, I lost sleep over it. And after I'd lost all my sleep, and after I'd worked all through the riddles of trying to figure out what matters in life, this also is vanity. Thinking about it all my life was ultimately a waste of my life too. There is nothing better, he says, for a person than that he should eat and drink and find enjoyment in his toil. This also I saw is from the hand of God. For apart from him, who can eat or who can have enjoyment? For the one who pleases him, God has given wisdom and knowledge and joy, but to the sinner, he has given the business of gathering and collecting, only to have to go to one who pleases God. He says, maybe the answer is this. And by the way, this little section is as close as Ecclesiastes gets to giving you the answer to the riddle. He says, maybe this is just the way it is. Maybe God gives you stuff and God takes your stuff away. So while you got it, just go ahead and enjoy it. He said, but when I tried that, even that, which seemed like a pretty good answer, this also is vanity and striving after wind. I just couldn't catch it. So you see the problem of trying to determine what matters, and you notice how vague Solomon is in this text. He doesn't say it's dollars and cents or necessarily possessions, though that's inclusive. It's everything he found to do in life. Every art, every hobby, every career, every enterprise, everything he set his mind to. He said, I just couldn't figure out how at the end of the day, when I face the grave, how would that give my life meaning? And all of us at some point are supposed to ask ourselves that question. One of the more famous answers given actually is outside the Bible. This will be a rare Sunday morning. I'm going to work through the Apocrypha for just a minute. In the Jewish text called Ben Sirach, which is a book written in between the Old and New Testament. It's not in your Bible for a reason. I'm actually going to tell you why. But it's a collection of wisdom. It's kind of like the book of Proverbs. It just has a lot of Jewish sayings in it. And in the book of Sirach, he tries to answer this question, and he comes up with this clever answer. He says, good times and bad, life and death, poverty and wealth come from the Lord. The gift of the Lord endures for those who are godly, and what he approves will have lasting success. There is a man who is rich through his diligence and self-denial, and this is the reward allotted to him. When he says, I have found rest, and now I shall enjoy my goods, he does not know how much time will pass until he leaves them to others and dies. Sirach says, this is the best we can do. You worked really hard and you got rich. The best you can do is set aside some time at the end of your life and enjoy it. One of these days your kids are going to get it and you don't know what they'll do with it. They may waste it all. So you make sure before you're all done that you enjoy what God gave you and what you worked so hard for. He says, that's the best we can do. Remember that little bit in yellow. He says, at the end of your life, you're just supposed to kind of sit back and say, I have found rest, and now I shall enjoy my goods. Well, it might not surprise you that Jesus is going to have a very different answer to this set of questions. And we're going to look now in Luke chapter 12, 13 through 15, which begins as kind of a strange scene. Jesus has reached a state of enough fame and enough respectability that people are now coming to him with kind of oddball requests. They want him to do things for them. And so in verses 13 and 15, he says, someone in the crowd said to him, "Teacher, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me." But he said to him, "Man, who made me a judge or arbiter over you?" And he said to him, "Take care and be on your guard against all covetousness, for one's life does not consist in the abundance of his possessions." So a man comes to Jesus, and he has a request. If you were here a week or so ago, we talked about Mary and Martha. Something kind of interesting at the end of that story, Martha says, "Hey, could you tell my sister she's wrong?" This story starts the same way. "Hey, could you tell my brother he's wrong?" We like it when Jesus tells other people they're wrong. I've often said, if you want a successful career in preaching, tell your church that everybody else is wrong and you're doing great. Right? And nobody disagrees with that sermon. Everyone's thrilled with that. And so they come to Jesus and say, "Hey, could you tell my brother he's wrong?" In particular, it has to do with a will and the dividing out of property and so forth. You know, family never gets closer until they start strangling each other over a will. And that's where, you know, the rubber hits the road. And here it seems to be that situation. But it turns out Jesus responds with something that sounds like irritation. Actually, I find it deeply satisfying when Jesus responds to someone with a little irritation, because I allow that to justify it when I'm occasionally a little irritated. But Jesus sometimes says, "I can't believe you asked that. Do you think that I came here for this?" Jesus, his heart and mind set towards Jerusalem and the cross, and someone says, "Well, while you're here, I've got this legal financial dispute I'd like you to settle." And Jesus is just not even remotely interested. That would have been bad enough, kind of an irritable answer to a question, but Jesus says, actually, we can go a step further. Actually, what you're asking about is most of the problem we have in the first place. The very thing you'd like me to arbitrate, your concern over possessions and wealth, is a lot of the reason he's going to the cross, because of human concern with a million things that just don't add up to much, that lead us to betray and hurt each other in so many ways, even brothers. He says, so you should beware. Rather than worrying about who gets what, you should look deep inside and see what kind of person you're becoming when you have this kind of desire. And then to illustrate this, because he's still not done, he gives us one of the Bible's more famous parables, the parable of the rich fool. Let me just read it for you here, verses 16 through 21. "And he told them a parable, saying, the land of a rich man produced plentifully. And he thought to himself, 'What shall I do? For I have nowhere to store my crops.' And he said, 'I will do this. I will tear down my barns and build larger ones. And there I will store all my grain and my goods. And I will say to my soul, soul, you have been ample goods laid up for many years. Relax, eat, drink, and be merry.' But God said to him, 'Fool, this night your soul is required of you, and the things you have prepared, whose will they be? So is the one who lays up treasure for himself and is not rich toward God.'" In many ways, this sounds very much like that little story told in the Syriac text. That would have been a Jewish book in circulation that people might have been familiar with in Jesus's time. The difference is he changes a couple of details along the way, and he changes the ending. The first thing Jesus changes in the Jewish wisdom version of this, it says, "You got rich by hard work and self-denial. Boy, you were a good man and you worked hard and that's how you got your money." In Jesus' story, how did the rich man get rich? It says, "The field brought forth plentifully." Did the rich man actually grow anything? Did the rich man actually do anything? In this parable, is the rich man responsible for anything that he got? He just had a good crop that year. It could have gone the other way. He could have had a terrible crop, and his neighbor could have had a good crop. But it just so happens that God blessed him. His field brought him something good. Folks, that is the first thing to remember when we want to think about wealth and possessions. If you think of them as things you earned, then you will think of them as things you deserve to enjoy. But if you realize it was never yours in the first place, and you really didn't do much to get it anyhow, then the way you view them is very different. The man proceeds to say, "Boy, I've got a problem. I've got too much." And rather than looking around and seeing people that have needs, he thinks of ways that he might keep and enjoy more of what he has. Building a barn, just for what it's worth, in case any of you are building a barn this afternoon, building a barn is not the sin. Interesting story in Genesis. Joseph goes into Egypt, and he anticipates there's going to be a famine. All of you that were at DBS remember this. And he tells Pharaoh, we need barns, right? We need to gather in all the grain and during the good years so that we can feed people during the lean years. But what's the difference? Joseph is saying, we need to gather stuff up so we can help people. The rich man is saying, you know, if I gathered up enough, I could help myself a very, very long time. Very different intention with that barn. And so he says to himself, and you know you're always at a good point in a parable when the man starts talking to himself. This is when something good happens. Soul, you can kind of see him rubbing his belly almost. I do. That's the way I imagine it. Eat, drink, and be merry. I mean, you've arrived. It's finally time. In his head, you deserve this. This is what it was all about. Eat, drink, and be merry. Almost a quotation, or at least a paraphrase of what Sirach said you should say. When you get wealthy, say, I deserve this rest, I'm going to enjoy it. And it's in that exact moment in the story when God peels the roof off and shouts down from heaven, fool! Right? Sirach is a wisdom book. It was telling you this is the definition of a wise man. Get rich and enjoy it. And Jesus says, I'll give you wisdom. God says, if you try that, you're a fool. It is the very height of foolishness. For all the reasons we already know. How come? Well, for one reason, you don't know you're going to get there. Let me just put it in really pragmatic terms for a moment. If you decide, I'm going to find the meaning of my life when I get to, say, I don't know, 65. There's at least the possibility that you die at 64, and that means nothing you did meant anything. If your plan is to someday have meaning in your life, you need to know you may not make it to someday. You may not make it to tomorrow. But more importantly, this man found meaning in his life by looking for how he might enjoy what he had, rather than looking to his relationship with God and how he might serve other people. The rich man does what Sirach told him, but God calls him a fool. It turns out, Jesus says, there is another kind of wealth which would, in fact, give life meaning if you pursued it. But it's not the kind that you could lose. It's not even the kind that death could take away from you. And death is the tricky bit, right? If we didn't die, a lot of these answers we've discussed today would be viable strategies. If you could tell me for certain, I'm going to live to a certain age, and I'll get so many years with my stuff that I saved up, maybe I could say that's worthwhile. But then there's this death thing, and the psalm says you just end up living in a grave anyway. What do we do about that? Jesus says there is a kind of wealth that does not get taken from you by the grave. There is a kind of meaning and significance to life that proceeds beyond the extent we expect any kind of wealth to have. This kind of wealth does not suffer from the problem of death. Throughout this series of Jesus the Master Teacher, we've been emphasizing that Jesus does things and teaches them. And let me suggest to you that Jesus demonstrates this kind of life perfectly. At the ripe old age of about 33 years old, the text says, it was now about the sixth hour, and there was darkness over the whole land until the ninth hour, while the sun's light failed, and the curtain of the temple was torn in two. Then Jesus, calling out with a loud voice, said, Father, into your hands I commit my spirit. And having said this, he breathed his last. What do we say when a young person tragically dies? What a waste. We say this was a person who never got to live the rest of their life. Their life might have had consequence and significance and meaning, but they never got there. Jesus died at 33. By any standard, he had some good years ahead of him. But when you look at the life of Jesus, you don't say, what a waste. when you look at the cross, you realize this was the most significant life that was ever lived. This was the most meaningful, important use of a human life that had ever been devised. And even the grave couldn't take it from him. Even dying did not change that he mattered. And what he did mattered. And the substance and significance of his life outlived him and continues to give our lives meaning today. He was rich toward God. And nothing stole that away. Christ is not a waste. His is the perfect life. And so what the New Testament tells us to do is to look to the teachings and the life of Jesus and say, are you trying to wait until one of these days your life means something? Or can you live this kind of life where even death cannot rob it from you? Paul says it like this: if then you have been raised with Christ, seek the things that are above, where Christ is, seated at the right hand of God. Set your minds on things that are above, not on things that are on earth. For you have died, and your life is hidden with Christ in God. When Christ, who is your life, appears, then you will also appear with him in glory. Why couldn't all the wisdom and wise men of the ancient world, why couldn't the sages and the sayers all say, here's the meaning of life? Because they were looking down instead of up. Because there is nothing you could, it wasn't they weren't smart enough or they didn't try hard enough. There is nothing you can find looking down that gives this life meaning. But when you look up, you can find it. And Christ spent his life looking up. And even crucifixion couldn't take that away. That was a life so full of meaning, the grave gave it back because it couldn't hold him. And that's the life he calls us to live. Take a minute this week, 60 seconds, I promise it won't kill you. And think about what you spend your life on. Where is your toil? Where is your anxiety? Where is your worry? Where is your stress? Where is your treasure? And where is your debt? Where have you bestowed all the value and meaning of your life? And if you have to look down to see all those things, you're looking the wrong way. Look up to where Christ, who is your life, is seated at the right hand of God. We're going to stand and sing a word of encouragement. If we can do anything to help you come to him, we would do it as we stand and sing.